terrorists, you know, just individuals interested in, you know, targeting white people and hateful of white people is just a total fictive. You know, I think in regards to Roy Mitchell, who's a primary character in the film, and William O'Neill's handler, you know, there's a reason why we kind of tried to make him complex as well, because I think that in a lot of ways, you know, his character highlights the dangers of being a white centrist, especially, you know, when you're a white person who, you know, works for the white power structure, and it doesn't get more, you know, you don't find anyone who does that even more so than an FBI agent. So
we have 5 seconds.
I think there's a myriad of things to take away from it, but those are some.
Shaka King, I want to thank you so much for being with us, and congratulations on this epic work. The film is Judas and the Black Messiah, premieres tonight at the Sundance Film Festival, out February 12th on HBO Max. That does it for our broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe, wear a mask.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, on 91.9 FM. Also on the web, we're at kboo.fm. Next up is More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You are listening to More Talk Radio on KBOO, and I am Cecil Prescott.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Carey, and it sounds like I've got a bit of an echo. Is that true?
I'm not hearing an echo, but
sounds okay to me.
Okay, good. Right. Okay, let me check with our engineer, Ty. Make sure we're good.
Sounds good to me.
Okay, that's all I need to hear. So, good morning indeed. You are listening to your community connection, KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the metro area, in the Columbia River Gorge, like in Hood River and White Summit, Washington. We would be 91.9. And in Philomath, my brain said, in Philomath, we would be 104.3. And on the web, it's kboo.fm. We want to thank our listeners, as I'm so fond of saying, far flung and wide. Hope you're enjoying this wonderful Monday morning.
And today is February 1st. 2021, the beginning of the month in which we recognize Black history. So,
You know, let us have a moment of admiration, not necessarily silence, but admiration for Cicely Tyson. And people don't understand this particular phrase, Black excellence. And they think, mm-hmm. Well, why so much focus and on the whole idea of it being Black? And one reason is because for the longest, we were taught that Black excellence was a misnomer. It did not exist. It was not possible. You know, when you are not regarded as human, how could you have excellence? And when you're regarded as inferior, how could you have excellence? How could you even comprehend the idea of excellence? But Cicely Tyson was most definitely an example of Black excellence. It's somebody striving to reach the stars despite adversity. And I have to say she had a profound effect on me and my life, and I'm thankful for everything that she did to lead us forward in terms of acting, in terms of personal challenges being overcome, in terms of facing down the demons of discrimination and racism by having high standards of character and morals and ethics and personal integrity, and once again, just being a stellar actress as well as a human being.
Yes, and she continued working throughout her lifetime. She never retired, and up until just before she died, she had just published her memoirs and was on a tour talking about that. So she's certainly an inspiration to women and men and people, as she reminded us, was able to meet the challenges and overcome them. So, Black
yes.
excellence.
Yes.
Tyson.
All right. So, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to review, since we began by talking about Black History Month, review and a piece that was in the New York Times over the weekend by Imani Perry, and it's titled, "Do We Ask Too Much of Black Heroes?"
Oh, interesting.
And they post that. I'll read a portion of it, and maybe we can talk, you know, just put that out there and also talk about our other topic this morning. Imani
okay.
Perry writes, in the early 20th century, before Negro History Week had turned into Black History Month, African American teachers and children in schools throughout the segregated South would paste images of celebrated figures of Black history on the walls of their schools. It was a public affirmation that greatness existed among their people despite oppression. As a woman born post-desegregation in 1972, I remember the photocopy programs featuring a list of names to celebrate: Sojourner Truth, W.E.B. Du Bois, Daniel Hale Williams, with facts go along with each. Even then, I knew these models of aspiration were meant to guard me against any feelings of inferiority that might come from not seeing my story in textbooks or on screens. Though the world has changed a great deal over the past century, celebrating heroes remain an important and familiar part of Black History Month ritual. It is consistent with the way Americans celebrate history. As the historian Benedict Anderson noted in Imagined Communities, his examination of the rise of nationalism in a national imagination in the solitary hero is possessed of qualities and abilities that exceed what we expect of a human being, and he, and it is usually he, invariably succeeds. In the history of the U.S., dominating the landscape and vanquishing all opponents, think George Washington and David Crockett, are classic hero traits. The hero becomes a proxy for the nation. Black historic political figures have been rendered as vanquishing heroes as well. Noble, brave, transcendent, they have remarkable stories. We tremble in awe before the recounting of Frederick Douglass escaping from slavery and Ida B. Wells narrowly escaping the Klan in Memphis. saving her own life. Then, through her investigative journalism into the practice of lynching, saving the lives of countless others. Martin Luther King Jr., who survived threats, bombs, and jail cells before falling to an assassin's bullet, has been rendered as the ultimate hero. His depiction is messianic. And though he was a key member of a vast and complex movement, he is often presented as singular. This is the way we tell history in the American public spheres. The Black American hero is necessarily more complicated than the mainstream, quote, great American heroes, end of quote. Both American and Black in a racially oppressive nation, he is a figure of double consciousness, often put to cross purposes. His greatness is trumpeted in order to reject the concept of Black inferiority and to assert belonging in the nation, a sign of legitimacy. "I too sing America," he sings, as Langston Hughes once put it. Or the hero might be a salvific figure, someone like Malcolm X or Huey P. Newton, who reject the racist nation. See, for example, the embrace of Marcus Garveyism in the Back to Africa movement in the early 20th century. Another type of Black hero is one who survives untold brutalities and lives to tell the tale, indicting white supremacy by his very existence. Heroes, as historians and activists have noted for generations, are often made mythic in ways that are troubling. Social change is never wrought by individuals. Movement is a collective endeavor, and the romantic ideal of the heroes obscures that truth. Recent social movements, like the Movement for Black Lives, have been deliberate about describing themselves as leaderless or leaderful in order to emphasize the importance of collective organizing while rejecting the model of the charismatic male leader. We are not following an individual, right? This is a leaderful movement. Patrice Cullors, a co-founder of the Black Lives Matter Global Network, told NPR in 2015, "These are groups on the ground that have been doing this work, and I think we stand on the shoulders of these folks." These organizers look to the tradition of the civil rights movement as inspiration, such as the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which oriented itself towards participatory democratic models rather than the model of King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which was organized in a way consistent with the Protestant Church. They have taken a lesson from the words of Ella Baker, the often overlooked architect of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Quote, "Strong people don't need strong leaders." The decision to choose leaderless or leaderful models is a refutation of the ideal of the traditional hero, martial, dominant, and authoritarian in style, if not substance. It also recognizes the ways in which so many important figures have been excluded from being cast as heroes because they don't fit the standard image, whether because of queerness, gender nonconformity, femininity, or mental or physical disability. The practice of overlooking these heroic people is ironic, given that navigating disadvantage often requires heroic labors. And although a few such outsiders make it into the annals, generally, it is only if they are seen as transcending their very human qualities. The traditionally constrained ideal of the Black hero is a challenge both within Black communities and in society at large. These lauded individuals are anointed as proxies for all Black people and interpreters of Black thought, which flattens the widely divergent ideas among Black people, among the political economy, social values, theology, racism, law, and so forth. Groundbreaking figures like Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, President Barack Obama, and Vice President Kamala Harris are subject to intense political debate, both within Black communities and without, over their ideology, their role in American policy, and their relationship to communities of color, even as we recognize the significance of being a trailblazing first of such consequences. No one person can tell the whole story, no matter how heroic that person might be. That said, heroes remain. They resonate with people for good reason. Human beings organize knowledge through storytelling. We create ourselves in light of the stories we hear and tell. Having stories that give us courage and inspiration are always necessary, but especially so when we face injustice. In trying times, and we are mightily tried, we need inspiration. Rather than an absolute rejection of the idea of the hero, we would do better to tell fuller and truer stories about those we place in those ranks, to deepen our understanding of them as fallible human beings. And we must include critically important people who are often left off the rolls. Ella Baker stands as a heroic figure and model for how to organize using a deeply democratic approach. Fannie Lou Hamer, a sharecropper who by many accounts was the more center of the struggle in the Mississippi Delta for voting and economic rights, and who was physically disabled after facing violent retaliation for her organizing work, is not a household name. Yet I have listened to civil rights organizers describing the emotional fortitude that came from hearing her sing, a woman beaten and bloody, neared to death, who nevertheless remained a soldier for freedom. Only recently has there been a revival of public recognition that Bayard Rustin, an openly gay Black man, was the architect of the March on Washington. And as young organizers have defined their own politics, people like trans liberation organizer Marsha P. Johnson have become heroes in our times. However, even as we expand the pantheon of who counts as heroes, the heroic figure remains a juggernaut. As we freeze them on an altar of adoration, we run the risk of losing our critical perspective regarding who they were or are as full, complex human beings. In the world of social media and information age with a 24-hour news cycle, heroes rise and fall in spectacular fashion on a daily basis. In the end, perhaps we find it necessary to refuse rendering any individual as heroes uncritically and instead settle on what we can agree about. There is an undeniable heroism in refusing and transcending the narrow boxes that racism creates and barriers it erects. We can acknowledge human fallibility and the sociological landscape out of which acts of heroism emerge. Heroes fail and they succeed, and sometimes they fall short of our hopes. Perhaps they betray them. Our hearts leap when they exceed them. The valleys as well as the heights of anyone's story must be deliberately attended to, including the stories of our heroic figures. Rather than serving as empty vessels into which we pour our fantasies, these figures can be taken on their own terms, including their full humanity. This was an article written by Imani Perry, who is a professor of African American Studies at Princeton, in the New York Times, January 29th, entitled, Do We Ask Too Much of Black Heroes? You are listening to More Talk Radio on KBOO. I am Cecil Prescott.
I am Celeste Carey, and you are welcome to call us and join in our conversation as we unroll another aspect of More Talk Radio today. It's 819. The phone number, go ahead and get it preset. It's 503-231-8187. This is the first day of February. Tomorrow is Groundhog Day, so we'll figure out whether we have 2 months or how does it go? A month and a half or 6 weeks of winter left, you know, which is pretty much the same. And now I'll roll out a topic here, our topic. And in a sense, I find that there's an interesting connection, because we're talking about the everyday person slogging through the mundane and the mud of human misery, trying to reach that transcendent spot. And that's what many of the immigrants in the approaching caravan headed toward the United States from the South American countries are no doubt feeling. They have their eyes firmly set on the prize, and they are marching. And they're hoping that this new president, the one that is not the mean one, as it's been quoted, some have said, will let them in. And whereas we are the land that welcomes those people from whatever trials and tribulations they're going through, we wonder, will they get the welcome that they expect? We're going through, in this nation, spasms that are tearing us apart and dragging us down. And if you look at some of the larger cities, not just along our southern border, but even right here in our own front and backyards, some of our places don't look much different than some of the refugee camps and immigrant camps that I've seen on the news. And one wonders, do we have the resources to match our stated compassion, our storied compassion, our promoted compassion that, you know, the Statue of Liberty has emblazoned on her book and on her vase, to say, come be here, be safe, run away from the terror. And in some cases, and this is kind of a parenthetical statement, I don't want to get into this too much, but sometimes we have been the cause of some of the terror that they are experiencing. But my point is, we have people coming here. Do our resources match our compassion? Do we still have that level of compassion? What do you think will happen when they get here? What should happen, even though in the midst of unemployment, COVID, homelessness, and other national spasms, what can we do? any additions to that, Cecil, as we open up our phone line?
Yeah, I think it's a challenge that we all face, and as we talk about the more newly arrived immigrants, we have to acknowledge that that all of us are immigrants of some sort, and where we sit, where KABU Station sits, on the ancestral homelands of the Multnomah, Clackamas, Tualatin, Kalapuya, Malala, bands of the Chinook, and many others who have made their homes along the Columbia River. And we honor the members of over 400 tribal communities who live in the Portland metro area. Many of us, all of us, are immigrants trying to find a new place. And also recognize that, as you suggested, Celeste, that the new administration is certainly different from the older administration, and has the Biden administration has issued a radically new immigration policy that we has proposed for the nation and enacted through executive orders, actions which create a more welcoming place for immigrants. At the same time, we need to recognize that this is an ongoing battle and challenge, and in terms of how the United States will welcome, accept more people, and it will describe who we are as a nation. The president's proposal would create an 8-year pathway to citizenship for millions of immigrants, set up a processing program abroad for refugees seeking admission to the United States, and push towards using technology to monitor the border. It brings relief to DACA people, deferred DACA program. So for those who were brought here as children, and it's an opportunity for a reset or restart in terms of our immigration policies. But people have different views and ideas about what that means. And as you suggest, Celeste, walking in the streets of towns and cities where so many people are in camps, many of those who are fleeing to this nation might encounter similar living conditions that they are fleeing from. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. Let's hear your thoughts and your opinion on these things. Celeste, I'm reminded that only recently that there have been actions here in Portland outside of ICE,
yes,
building, and that continues to be a point of where people gather to proclaim their opposition to the policies of ICE and what our government is doing to welcome or not welcome people. And we cannot forget the millions of, if not the hundreds of children who have been separated from their parents on our borders. Children cages.
Mm-hmm. Yes, not only children in cages, but, people dying in the midst of some of these incarcerations and then arrest and detainment on the way here. But it's, you know, it's not just the demonstration that we had. The station itself, KABU itself, has been getting some very interesting anti-immigrant statements plastered to our walls and sidewalks in front of our building. And so we've been kind of diligent in taking them down. People mistake our board of positive statements regarding Black Lives Matter and people of color as an opportunity to put all kinds of propaganda up there. And it's like, no. And so I try to keep it policed, and my colleague Jenna tries to keep it policed, and the rest of the staff as well. And some people might take umbrage to use of the word policed, I'm sure, but we're vigilant in trying to keep the station clear as a statement of support for all people, and especially for folks of color. So when we see anti-immigrant statements in front of us, we wonder what perspective are people coming from. Some people are saying, well, you got to have papers. You must have documentation. You must be valid and legal. And I understand that it's important that people, quote unquote, pay their dues, you know, go through the hoops. I don't think sometimes that they understand that this whole idea of becoming legal sometimes is fraught with unfairness. And in some ways, though it may be a law, it's about as ethical and as moral as poll taxes or having your apartheid papers. You know, it's really important that we pay attention to what is an ethical stance when it comes to people coming into the country. And then there's this other stance, well, there's problem with overpopulation, and I have a hard time tolerating that, because just about every argument I have heard about overpopulation comes from a white person, generally a white man, and it's white culture. White culture, and especially white supremacist culture, that has rendered the concept of overpopulation in an area, geographic area, possible. I mean, if we were to share our resources and our technology in an equitable fashion, there would not be any place in Appalachia, in Brazil, in parts of Asia, in parts of Africa, maybe excuse me, even in Russia, where you couldn't get clean water, there would be no such thing. We'd all have clean water, and we'd all have the technology to make the most of the land we have without there being problems like dust bowls or erosion, or, you know, people dying from polluted water or bad sewage, you know. And so I don't have any tolerance for that. But if there was a problem, it would be, how do we welcome people in the midst of not being able to care for our people that we have here? And I have the compassionate heart. So I'm just curious, where are people? How do we share that one piece of bread we have with real love, and not be overly concerned with the fact that this is yet another person here in front of us and whose needs need to be met?
Karen is on the line.
Okay. Good morning.
Oh, good morning, Celeste and Cecil. So good to hear your voices. I just wanted to speak about immigration from the point of view of moral responsibility. We have, as a country, afflicted people in Central America and South America by supporting every damn dictator that rose up in those countries, sending arms, doing horrible things to train people suppress. For example, in El Salvador, the peasant organization, I use that word as a technical organization, a word for peasant, farming folks, trying to form a union, and the death squads were supported by this country.
Yes.
We have supported the overthrow of democratically elected Arbenz. We have been horrible, and as a result of course, United Fruit and other corporations overriding the natural economies in those countries, people have become increasingly desperate. And of course, climate change, which is driven in large part by this country, not by the folks down in Central America or South America, climate change is affecting them badly. I feel, and also how we've treated immigrants under Trump, with the farm workers, is absolutely appalling. Doing things like spraying their houses at night, even here in Oregon, with pesticides, not giving them adequate sanitary facilities or masks or any other equipment that they would need to fight COVID. The way that they've been treated in the meatpacking plants, they have been treated in many ways as slave labor. And I'm a member of a Quaker congregation as well as a Jewish congregation, and both congregations have taken up immigrant rights as well as African-American rights as special focus. And we were able at the Quakers to get a Cameroonian refugee from genocide out of federal prison. Yeah, and we've been supporting his efforts to get all kinds of documentation, also supporting him when he needed it financially and giving him a place to stay. And he's now working at TriMet, sanitizing buses and the like. He's a great human being, and we love him. It's that simple. Genocide is something that strikes right to my heart as a Jewish person. And so I saw immigrants being scapegoated by that last horrible, I'm going to cry, administration. Okay, as soon as I saw that, I said, oh my God, this is what was done to Jews, okay? All kinds of lies, et cetera, and the brutal treatment and exploitation. And so we've also been able at the Quakers to, through a fund that we've developed to pay legal filing fees for all kinds of documentation, we've been able to help more than 20 or 25 people so far. It's not many, but, you know, we've got a lawyer who does most stuff pro bono. We once had three active immigration lawyers who are fighting like hell to help folks. Now we have one active one. And so, but she's amazing, and she even helped a friend of mine become a Mexican American, okay? She got citizenship. So, yeah. So there are things that congregations and people can do. My Jewish congregation has a tutoring program in the Ortiz community, and I have a little tutoree whom I adore. She's 10 years old. She's in the fourth grade. She's so cute. And she's just wonderful and really, really smart. So yeah. I feel it's coming from my heart, you can tell, and I'm sorry if I talk too long, but there's lots of people can do to help that can make big differences so that people can get a leg up and be able to support themselves. That's really, I understand all the things you were saying, Celeste, about the economy. It's just that we owe a debt. It's not just compassion. It's that we also have a responsibility for the crimes that have been committed in our name. So anyway, I love you both, and I'm going to get off because I'm getting too emotional. But thank you so much. Thank you.
Well, thank you for your call. And you know, one of the things I appreciate is she reiterated the very thing that you and I were saying, Cecil, about how we have caused harm in these countries. Sometimes we cause harm through our political policies, our military incursions. You know, let it be remembered that Oliver North said he sold cocaine to buy guns to help support an insurrection, you know, in another country, and that yes. our School of the Americas taught military personnel terrorism technique.
Yes. Yeah, I appreciate the caller raising the diverse, the uplifting, the moral call to duty that we all have, and highlighting the work of her religious organizations. For many years now, religious congregations of many faiths have been involved in immigrant justice. And I'll just lift up one organization you might approach if you are a member of a religious organization and want to learn more about immigrants' rights. That's the Interfaith Movement for Immigrant Justice here in Oregon, Emerge. And you can go to their website, imirj.org, to learn how you might participate in struggling with immigrants for justice. And as our caller just mentioned, some of the work that her religious congregations are doing that rises out of their ideology, their philosophy, and their faith. There are many, many groups who are doing many good things, and especially during that time when immigrants are often seen as quote-unquote the enemy. To lift up this issue under the banner of morality is important.
Francis on the line.
Okay, and for those who want to call, don't forget our number is 503-231-8187. And good morning, you're on the air.
Francis.
Hi. I was happy your last caller brought that subject up of the exploitation that has been and is taking place in the Central America that is causing people to flee. I think right now with Congress, we're having that discussion about whether we have the resources to provide the compassionate help that is needed to the American for the American people right now. And again, the irony is that the concern now is how much it costs.
Yes.
And the people, as I understand it, who advised President Biden to write in his proposed legislation, they went from the perspective of seeing what is needed and then putting a price tag on it. And that's the price tag they came up with. So if that's what is needed, then that's what we should do.
Yes.
But I think an irony for me is that President Biden, you know, just recently ordered that the contracts with private prisons be not renewed.
Indeed, yes.
And I think that's a nice little first step. But the irony for me is that when the former President Trump pardoned 143 people during his last weeks in office, 12 of them were people who have been in prison for lengthy sentences for nonviolent drug offenses. And one of them was released just the other day. His name is Corbin Cooper. He's from California. And in 2013, he was convicted of transporting marijuana from California to one of the Carolinas. And because he had prior charges, he was given a sentence of life without parole.
Wow.
And he was like maybe 32 or something like that. And he had two young daughters. But President Trump pardoned him. And they did a story on him the other day when he was released, and he said he literally was in his cell and they came and told him he had 5 minutes to get his stuff together and get out of there.
Wow.
And imagine how that man feels right now.
Yeah.
He was, and his family. He was reunited with his daughters and his family. And
but Francis, I know Biden, you wanted to talk about it, about the hundreds of other people who are locked up in prison, correct?
Exactly. And that President Biden now has the opportunity to revisit that crime bill that he co-wrote, that caused all the mass incarceration, and perhaps he can find a few more people that should be released from prison. That would be a wonderful thing. To me, you know, I was reading about Frederick Douglass, and I found some interesting things that made me happy because of my Irish heritage and his visit to Ireland and his perspective of what was going on in Ireland at the time and how he kind of had a meeting of the mind with O'Connell, who was a leader of the revolution in Ireland. And to me, the real heroes are the ex-cons walking among us right now, who are gracefully and with dignity living their lives in spite of all the unjust, I won't say the word, but you know what it is, that they've gone through.
Yes.
Because of what? Because somebody's notion of supremacy? Somebody's notion of being supreme? I don't know what, I mean, they are.
It's so many things that get laid on top of that. You know, it's not just an idea of white supremacy. Even if the person was just a bigot, there's still economic greed. There's still that desire for power that even if they somehow are not tainted by outright and purulent racism,
well, you know
they
what?
Can still be greedy,
exactly.
You know, and so there's so many reasons
but
why.
Tell me this,
get caught.
Well, I know people. Okay, I hear you, but I
no,
want
I'm
to know.
I'm talking about the politicians, not the people who are formerly incarcerated. I'm talking about politicians. They inflict so much,
exactly.
much evil on us for different
but
reasons.
This is, I know, and if it's just for the money.
Uh-huh.
I know a whole lot of people who make a whole lot of money that would never, ever, 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 ever treat somebody else like that.
Oh, I
if
agree.
It meant making some money, they wouldn't make the money.
I
but these people have a way of looking the other way and pretending like they don't know, and I'm tired of it, you know. But we'll see what happens. It seems like maybe it's maybe a little bit more truth. That's one thing I'll give Trump. He lifted up that rug.
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
And everything that swept underneath is right there for everybody to see, and now we got to decide what we're going to do about it.
Yeah. And you summed it up perfectly.
All right. You guys take care.
You too, Francis. Thank you. And the cry for criminal justice reform continues. We've mentioned the president has ended by executive order any more contracts with private prisons. He promised to end cash bail. And as Francis suggested, in terms of reversing his support of the vicious crime bill in the 1990s that he supported, he has called for the ending of mandatory minimum sentencing, and he is the first person to sit in the White House who is against the death penalty, which has been racially targeted to black and brown people. So we have to continue to push not only the president and his administration, but continue the work for criminal justice reform, not only nationally, but also in our states. And there's a lot of work yet to be done.
Thomas is on the line.
Good morning, Thomas.
Yeah, hi. Hey, listen, I've got to thank Cecil for recognizing the tribes of the area here, because I suggested that once, and I think that should be brought up, you know, as the preamble to starting various shows on KBOO, to keep that in front of people, because we don't do that. You know, I mean, when I and then when Cecil said that, and I thought, yeah, we're occupiers of Indian territory here. That's the reality of it, and I think it's good to bring that forth, and I just wanted to thank Cecil for saying that. But also, in terms of Black History Month, what I'd like to see during this month, we've got a whole month here ahead of us, is to focus on Abraham Lincoln, and Abraham Lincoln as an icon and a mythological figure in our culture, about what he did. You know, I'm a white guy. Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves, Emancipation Proclamation, and all of that sort of thing. But if you look more deeply into the history, it's not so clear. I mean, it's like it's one of these Christopher Columbus things, you know, where there's a lot more detail and a lot more nuance to what Lincoln did and said, during that period before the Emancipation Proclamation, during his debates and things like this, and the struggle that he had to balance, his desire to free the slaves, but also to appease the slave states. And I'm reading this book. It's called Unsettling Truths: The Ongoing Dehumanizing Legacy of the Doctrine of Discovery. And these authors, give a quote, and it's a short quote. And if I could read it, it says, "This is a quote from Abraham Lincoln. He said, 'My paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union, and is not either to save or destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing some of the slaves and leave others alone, I would do that.'" Well, that quote leads these authors to say that Lincoln, he firmly believed that black lives not matter. Now, that's what they said. But that makes me think, wow, this deserves a little more looking into details on, you know, what was actually going on at that time with Lincoln. And I just want to bring that up. We don't have to solve this today, but I thought that's a huge thing. Lincoln is huge in Black history, and I thought it would be good to, you know, to explore that a little bit on KBOO.
Well, I can't say we'll be doing the show on that, because unless a programmer wants to handle it. But what you're saying is not news to black people. We knew that. I was taught that in grade school.
Is that right?
So, yeah. See, it might be news to white people, but it's not news to black people.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
And so, you know, I don't view Lincoln as huge in black history, because he's not a black man. Unless you give credence to some work that has been done by historians that say he was of African ancestry. Now, we've had people go back and forth on that. I mean, he was teased as being called Africanus Lincoln, but that's a whole different story altogether. That's for another day. But I think it's important to pass that on among white listeners and white communities, because you summed it up perfectly. His allegiance was to the Union, not to the people. And although he was a spiritual and compassionate man, he was also a man of his times and of the political expediency, you know, of his era. So, you know, thanks for sharing that, though, because if you had not got to that in talking about Lincoln, I was going to mention it.
Well, you know, that's one thing, just one more short statement here, that I feel, you know, that you said you were taught that, you know. I wasn't taught that. I know what I was mm-hmm. taught. You know, I grew up in one of the greatest racist cities in this country, in Dearborn, Michigan. I mean, there were no black people, and Mayor Hubbard did not want any black people. That's the environment that I grew up in. And I feel now, I'm 74, I feel like I have been lied to so much, and I so much resent that people knew these things and I wasn't told that. You know, I grew up in that kind of a culture where I've lived my whole life, you know, with these lies, and it seems like the lies are everywhere. You know, so
yes, they anyway. Are. But look at this. I want to leave you some light at the end of the tunnel.
Okay.
Here we are now. You're 74. This is 2021. You know this now. We have the technology for you to not only learn more, but to share. How much more powerful are you now to tell the truth that you didn't know?
Exactly. And that, you know, people hate the internet. They hate all of these phones and all that sort of thing, but it is a powerful tool to learn and study the history. And I've just woken up to that, you know, in my later life. And it's just amazing the things you can learn. Thank you very much.
I'm glad you learned it, and thank you for sharing it.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, you know, that was an interesting conversation.
So, you know, I wanted to say something for a lot of white people who may not know. They say, "Well, how come Lincoln is not so big? You know, don't quote unquote you all name yourselves Lincoln and Jefferson and Washington." And you know, there was a code to that. And the code was overtly coming from white supremacist culture, it meant this is a place where we're going to put them darky, okay? Coming from a black or colored or Negro perspective, depending on the, you know, the years, it meant it was a safe place to be. So you had to know the code to make it relevant. You know, youngins nowadays and in some of our popular culture, they give away a lot of the culture's secrets and the codes, you know, to make a buck or what have you. But there's a lot of layers to this. And if you went to a place and it was called Franklin or Jefferson or something, there was a good chance that this was a good, safe place to stay or to associate. And it was one of the features that would have been picked up and echoed in the Green Book. I remember learning this as a kid from my family and having traveled, you know, I was born in Indiana, but we traveled south. And so you get on those places, you'd learn that stuff. But I want to thank the people for calling. Go ahead, Cecil.
Yeah, I just wanted to say also for the last caller, where he was talking about his revelation about Lincoln not being the great emancipator, to go back to my earlier comment when I read the piece from Imani Perry, that real change happened when ordinary people do extraordinary things. And so it wasn't Lincoln the great emancipator. It were people who were rebelling against the slave system. It were no-name people who became part of revolutionary movements. And so real change happens not only because of some special heroic person, but because of mass movements. Not only for the ending of slavery, but also we see today as we talk about immigrant justice, criminal reform, and things that continues today.
So we want to thank people for calling and supporting the idea of human rights. And we thank you for those people who have supported KBOO and ask you if you financially this past year and your annual contribution, the period is not up, tell somebody else. You know, if you've made your contribution for the 12-month period and you're not due and you're not in a position to increase it, tell somebody else. Bring somebody else in, not only as a listener, but as a supporter. I want to thank our engineer, Ty, and we will hear you next week. Stay tuned, because coming up next on Your Community Connection, KBOO Portland, is the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Now what we're going through is trying for a brighter day. And all this confusion too, we're clearing for a better way. Day to day we seem perplexed in search of some direction. I'm astounded and I'm vexed from dumbing we need protection.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8:59 a.m. Next up, we have the Old Mole Variety Hour.
And Mrs. Radioland, I am Eldridge Cleaver, the former Minister of Information of the Black Panther Party. You are listening to KBOO Portland. This is listener-sponsored, non-commercial community radio. I want you